his last hearing, Bob Anderson, an assistant U.S. attorney, said Young committed an act of terrorism by trying to impose his will on others by using violence. In New Jersey, there's currently six animal liberation activists who will begin trial tomorrow, accused of interstate stalking and conspiracy. Each of these individuals faces up to 24 years in prison and are basically being accused, in essence, of running a website that's opposed to a contract testing laboratory called Huntington Life Sciences. There's no coincidence that the highly publicized Senate hearings on eco-terrorism, these two trials, the raids and subsequent grand jury subpoenas in San Francisco, who, by the way, were targeted against many of the same individuals who were doing support work for these trials, are happening in such close proximity. These actions represent an attack by the federal government aimed at straining our resources, breaking our resolve, and imprisoning our activists. These actions are also indicative of the renewed wave of repression directed against all social change movements. There's another grand jury operating in California as we speak, investigating actions that occurred some 30 years ago. The federal government is escalating its campaign against the Assad Shakur. It's clear that the government needs to stamp out resistance wherever it thrives. As the government continuously redefines words such as violence and terrorism to include the opening of cages, the running of websites, and the fight against oppression, they further their ultimate goal of outlawing dissent altogether. It is imperative that we stand up to this type of thuggery and in support of those who find themselves targeted by government harassment. I refuse to cooperate with this grand jury or with any other, despite where I may face. In the coming months, many of us will need your support and solidarity. Protests will be held outside of San Francisco courthouse during each of the dates that we're called to appear. And as of now, those dates haven't been solidified, but it seems that they'll be at the end of June or at the beginning of July. We are going to have a sign-up list, I believe, that will be on one of these tables back over there. And we would ask that you would please put down your email address so we can keep you informed of our upcoming demonstrations and events and support actions. We're also going to be needing fundraising and donations. If anyone can help out or help put on an event to raise some money, it's going to be legal costs associated with this, as well as personal costs. People are going to have rent paid and things like that if they have to go inside. So with that, I want to thank Station 40 for allowing us to be here tonight, put on this event. Thanks to all the speakers for coming. We had to throw this together on sort of short notice, as the units just went out in the last couple of weeks. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Mark Vermolen. Say a few things about Mark.
Be nice.
Mark has been practicing law since 1984 and has been a member of the National Lawyers Guild since his first year in law school. He has represented activists throughout these years, including those engaged in civil disobedience and also civil disobedience and direct action. He has represented and worked with groups including the AIDS Coalition, Unleash Power, Hunting and Life, or Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty, the Rainforest Action Network, the Ruckus Society, the National Lawyers Guild AIDS Network, and numerous other social justice groups. I can't really say enough about Mark. He works tirelessly defending activists and saving off government repression all the time. I'm sure many of you have been activists for long in the Bay Area. You probably benefited at some point from either his hard work or his representation. So Mark's going to be talking about the legal aspects of your injury.
Thank you. I'm choked up. I am going to be talking about grand juries. I'm going to be talking in a bit more of a nuts and bolts way than the other two speakers. So my presentation will be more about information, and I think theirs will be more about inspiration. But perhaps melding the two is something that we can look at doing, and I'll hope to also provide some insight into the grand jury process to perhaps give people ideas about how your support through this process can make a difference to the folks that are subpoenaed. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how grand juries are used to target activists. I wanted to then talk about how activists' rights and any other person's rights are denied when they're subpoenaed to grand juries, and that obviously is very deliberate. I want to talk about giving an overview about the process from subpoena to testimony in the grand jury or resistance to testimony in the grand jury room. And then I wanted to talk also about how the system is set up to punish activists for resisting the grand jury process. How grand juries are used to target activists. Typically, grand juries are federal. There are state grand juries or county grand juries that go on, but typically grand juries are federal. That means the stakes are a lot higher. That means the resources are much more numerous as well. And in this instance, for example, where the 10 individuals have been subpoenaed, the resources behind this grand jury investigation are enormous. Josh referred to a number of the organizations, the law enforcement organizations that are involved in this. I'm sure that there are others, but those are only those are just the ones that we know of right now. The proceedings are secret. They are deliberately set up to be secret because of the intimidation factor. So getting things out in the open, talking to your friends about it, demystifying the process for people can make a big difference. Grand juries are supposed to be used to investigate or used to indict or bring federal charges against individuals. But that investigative power is so broad that it often loses the supposed target of the investigation, or it loses the focus of the investigation. And the questions that can be asked in a grand jury room aren't limited by what the prosecutor frames as the investigation on the outside. So, for example, these subpoenas that have been served state on them that the investigation is into the disappearance of Daniel Andreas San Diego a number of years ago. But once these individuals walk into the grand jury room, we fully expect that the questions that they're going to be asked are much more far-ranging, much more broad, much more encompassing of the government's view of eco-activism and other related issues. Grand juries are also a tool for the government to bring conspiracy charges. A conspiracy charge is, as a lot of you know, a really powerful tool for the feds and a really powerful tool for any of the prosecutors, because it is a way to try to bring pressure on those that associate with, are friends with, have done completely lawful things with others that the prosecutor is targeting. So the fact that these 10 are the ones that are named here doesn't mean that those are the only individuals that they're interested in. And I say that not to intimidate anyone or not to create consternation around anyone, but to illustrate the importance of knowing what's going on, talking with your friends about what's going on, being in communication rather than being in isolation, because there's nothing more that the government would want than for someone in this process to be isolated. And finally, how grand juries target activists is that they're clearly politically motivated. This is very obviously and transparently a coordinated effort by the feds in New Jersey, in Wisconsin, in San Francisco to target activists, to discombobulate activists at this important time, and to, as a broader strategy and a longer-term strategy, to try to break the movement. Rights at grand jury hearings. That's a very short list. Typically there's no right to be, so the list of what you don't have the right about in the grand jury process is a bit longer. You typically don't have the right to be informed of what the grand jury is what the grand jury investigation is about. One of the lawyer's key tasks often when people are subpoenaed is to scramble, talk with whoever else is subpoenaed, talk with whoever else is on the case, try to figure out what's going on. Here we have, at least to some degree, a little bit of a jump start on that, because the subpoenas say what the prosecutor says the investigation is about. We have a bit more of a jump start because we know of the Shack trial. We know of the raids on the homes in San Francisco and Oakland that occurred on April 10th. And because we're in communication, when I say we, I mean you, and I mean the lawyers, and I mean the folks that are subpoenaed. So we're steps ahead on that already. What rights do you also lose? Well, the subpoenas that are served in this case, and often the subpoenas that are served in other grand jury investigations, also are subpoenas to bring documents into the grand jury. And in this instance, the grand jury subpoenas command the people that are subpoenaed to bring in all documents that are relevant to establishing that Josh, in the instance of his subpoena, or anyone else, harbored or assisted Andreas in any way over the last couple of years. Well, you can imagine that that might pose a bit of a problem if you're a lawyer, or it might be a bit bothersome that your client is being commanded to bring in documents that the government is going to then use to prosecute him. There are ways of resisting that, but the grand jury subpoena can be for a person and can be also for documents. The right to a lawyer. Josh already spoke about that. Of course, you have a right to a lawyer, a right to consult with a lawyer before you testify. You have a right to consult with a lawyer actually as you're testifying, but we'll talk about the very strict limits on that. The prosecutor in this instance didn't make as clear as the law makes clear an individual's right to a lawyer. The subpoenas that went out with the very kind cover letter that went out informing people of what their rights were said that if you have a retained lawyer, that they would be happy to have that person represent you. They didn't mention that if you don't have the money to hire a lawyer, that the court is going to appoint one to represent you. It's another way that they perhaps comply with the purely legal requirements, but sort of sort of walk a tightrope around the ethical requirements of informing people that are subject to grand jury subpoenas. Once they get to the grand jury, the actual grand jury room, you don't have a right to have a lawyer in the grand jury room. But there are things that can be done to work around that. Obviously, that also is for the purpose of intimidating and for the purpose of making it as difficult as possible for somebody that is subpoenaed to the grand jury. The last of the rights that you don't have is the constitutional right to remain silent. You do have it up to a point, but how grand juries proceed, and I'll talk about this when I get to the ways that activists are punished in connection with the grand jury proceedings, is that you do have a right to remain silent, but as soon as the government gives you immunity for your testimony, says we will not prosecute you for the testimony that you give, you have to talk if you're going to comply with the grand jury subpoena. And that means that you would have to give information about everyone else that you know if you were going to comply with the law around grand juries. That's obviously a huge problem, but we can talk about tactics around that as well. This next section folks may pretty much know. Let me kind of get a showing of hands. How many folks have been through a grand jury process to some degree with friends, family, comrades, that sort of thing? For how many of you is this process completely new, except for maybe some things that you've read a little bit about or seen on TV or that sort of thing? Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit then about the kind of step-by-step of going through grand jury proceedings without touching on all the details. First step, somebody subpoenaed. They typically do it on very short notice. The subpoenas that went out last week were for testimony that was supposed to start tomorrow and go through June 8th. So they serve the grand jury subpoenas. The purpose behind that, obviously, is to jam people and try to not allow them to organize, try to not allow them to get their thoughts and their representation together. A really critical stage there, as is any stage where you're confronting law enforcement or faced with law enforcement, is it's very important for individuals to understand that they have the right to say absolutely nothing to agents, even in the face of intimidation, even in the face of psychological tactics, even in the face of the kindest of questions that the agents might ask. And that is something that I always recommend to my clients, that they not talk with agents, even if it's about ostensibly innocuous things. And there are legions of examples of what look like innocuous questions from law enforcement, just as they're delivering documents that turn out later to be very important. So the subpoena goes out. What's important at that point in time? From a legal perspective, often the timing is important because grand juries sit for 18-month periods of time. That 18-month period of time becomes important if someone's going to resist the grand jury and risk going to jail by not testifying. It's important because that jailing can last only for the duration of that grand jury. So time is often on the side of the defense. I do criminal defense work, and time is often on the side of folks that are subpoenaed. So that's a factor in looking at the overview of how grand juries work. That 18-month timeline is an important one. What is the purpose of grand juries? They investigate. They also indict. So in the grand jury is a prosecutor. In this instance, it's the very same prosecutor that is conducting the investigation seemingly around Andreas's disappearance, as was the prosecutor that issued the search warrants for the homes in San Francisco and in Oakland back in April. And the investigation there, at least on the face of the search warrant, was to investigate folks assistance to Peter Young over the years. Ostensibly a different purpose, we don't believe that it's a different purpose. So you've got the grand jury, which is a group of citizens that are sitting, identities unknown, not typically from the activist community, as you might imagine. I don't know if I'm going to get the time period right, but I think that the grand jury sitting just before this one of the grand jurors after his or her service was interviewed and asked about the process and asked about the number of cases that came before them and asked what the results were on each of the cases that came before them. And as it turns out, perhaps not surprisingly to anyone here, each time the prosecutor asked the grand jury to indict an individual, the individual was indicted each time. So it's not a broad searching mechanism that looks to find truth. It's a tool used by the government to bring indictments. It's a tool used by the government for political purposes, and they are many. I won't touch on them, but they are many and they are interconnected, and I think now more than before. Josh alluded to some of those very articulately. It's not just about the animal rights movement here. It's not just about the eco-rights movement. It's not just about any particular group. It's about dissent. It's about dissent. It's about activism. It's about dissidence. Subpoena the grand jury. That's the layout of the grand jury. Once somebody's subpoenaed, we go into sometimes negotiation. One of the first things we do is negotiate for time. The subpoenas that were served for June 1st have now been kicked over to June 22nd. There may be additional time that's necessary and additional time that's requested. There's discussion between the prosecutor and the attorneys, typically. There's other tactics that can be undertaken, but typically there's discussion between the prosecutor and the attorney. There's obviously preparation that goes into it. I will be consulting with Josh. There have already been meetings among counsel. There have already been meetings among counsel and clients strategizing around this. There will be more than has occurred. Physically, if the day comes and the individual is going into the grand jury room, we will go to the door of the grand jury room together, and I will stand outside the door, and Josh will go into the room if they continue to demand that he give testimony in front of the grand jury. He will go in with a pad of paper and a pencil, and he will go in understanding what he has said here, and that is that he is not going to give any information to the grand jury save for his name. He's going to stand on his Fifth Amendment right. An individual has absolutely the right to do that. There are consequences, potential consequences to that, and we will discuss those. But I will be stopped at the door. I will not be in there with him. Things that flow from that, it's the final area that I'm going to be talking about, and that is how activists are punished, how others might be punished, but typically this is around activism. How are activists punished? By not cooperating with the process. They can be punished in a number of ways. But the typical procedural way that it comes about is that someone like Josh has the conviction behind their principles to stand on not testifying, to stand on not giving information about themselves, even if he has information about himself that might be of interest to the government. He's not going to give information about others, even if he has information about others that might be of interest to the government. So he will stand on that principle. What the prosecutor can do in response to that are several things, but the two basic things that the prosecutor can do is to say, okay, I respect that, you are excused. That is unlikely to happen. Actually, a kind of an adjunct to that is that they might say, you are a target. We are now acknowledging that you are a target of this investigation. A target means we're not really interested in investigating what you have to know. We are interested in prosecuting you, and we already know that, and we already know that we can go into a grand jury and we can get that indictment, but we're subpoenaing you here. So that's also a consequence that can come out of it, out of the refusal to testify, the admission by the government that they actually weren't looking for him to testify, but they were rather looking to indict him. What can also come out of that, though, what can also come out of Josh's or anyone else's refusing to testify is that the government can then say, okay, we are going to grant you legal immunity from prosecution based on what you say in the grand jury room. And immunity is a legal concept that says that the prosecution cannot use what is said in the grand jury room against the individual who says it. They can use it against anyone else. They can use those things and perhaps develop things from them, and then if they develop things from what is said in the grand jury room, they can try to say, oh, well, we didn't really get it from his testimony, we got it from some other source, so we're still going to prosecute you, even though we granted you immunity back there. But where it's what it's usually used to do is, in the case of activists, particularly those that they know are not going to testify and have made it clear that they're not going to testify, is that they use it as a tool to put this individual in jail. They use it as a tool to intimidate or try to intimidate the community and that individual by putting them in jail. And the legal principle behind that is, it goes something like this, that if you're granted immunity, you have to testify because you can't harm yourself by testifying. And if you refuse to testify, even after you're granted immunity, you will see the light after a period of time. All you have to do is be put in jail for long enough, and then you will see the light. And you will determine that it's in your better interest to testify, and so they put you in jail ostensibly to coerce you into testifying, and they can keep you in jail for the duration of that 18-month grand jury, and I won't get into all the details about that, but at that, the end of that 18 months, a new grand jury can be seated, and that whole process can begin again. That individual can be subpoenaed again. They can be called in front of the grand jury again. They can be granted immunity and thrown in jail for a new period of 18 months. And so that is often a critical stage, or it's a particularly dramatic stage. Quite frankly, everything leading up to that is a critical stage. Your being here tonight is a critical stage. Being at the rallies that are going to be happening, talking with your friends and letting them know what's going on are critical stages. Being at the courthouse when these proceedings are going to be beginning are critical stages, because all of that is obviously the social and the political impact, quite frankly, are much bigger than the legal impact. And so what you are doing and what you can do is, in the end, likely going to make a lot more difference than what I and the other attorneys are doing. But what it also does is that it illustrates to the court and it illustrates to the prosecutor that this is an individual who, if you put him in jail for 18 months, if you put him in jail for 16 months, he's not going to testify. He's got community behind him. He's got conviction behind his principles. He has made clear what he is doing and what he is not doing. And so there is a mechanism, not often, there's a mechanism not often used, but when it's used, it can be very impactful, that if the judge does put that individual in, from the legal perspective, I can go in a week later, a month later, 3 months later, as many times as I need to convey the message to the judge that this person is not changing. And so your attempt to coerce and the legal basis for putting this person in jail to try to coerce them into giving testimony isn't going to work with him. So with the legal principle knocked out, there's no reason to keep him in jail. That kind of ties in, or at least I'm trying to tie in everything that's going on, that has gone on so far, and everything that will go on from here forward. And we have actually seen judges take notice of the support in courtrooms, the rallies outside, the letters that are written, the clarity of conviction of the individual, the clarity of conviction of the individuals that the subpoenaed individual hangs with. And judges take note of that. So it's really critical when it gets to that critical stage of the process, because, yes, we'll give the person all the support that they need and all the support that they want while they're in, but we'd much rather have them out, and we'd much rather have them out sooner rather than later. Let's see. That's really what I have. And I've just touched on some ideas around the grand jury and some ideas around support and how those two things can mesh. There will be more specifics that we'll put out through emails, that we'll put out through other community meetings about how those things can dovetail and how those various principles can really help each other. I personally really appreciate all of you being here, and I appreciate being able to work with folks like Josh and Anita and attorneys like Christine and people that really make the work that I do fulfilling and rewarding. So thank you.
Next up, Anita's going to talk, and Anita's a longtime animal liberation activist. She works for independent animals, and in the year 2000, Anita was called to testify before a federal grand jury in San Francisco. She responded by refusing to cooperate outright, and didn't even show up, and she's going to talk about that.
Hi. I know Josh touched earlier on how my grand jury subpoena came out of our mutual arrest. And so I'm going to go back a little bit and really lead up to my grand jury subpoena and then my process through it. And so what had happened was a group of us had formed an organization called Coalition to Abolish the Fur Trade San Francisco, and we started a campaign against Neiman Marcus's sale of fur. And part of our campaign was weekly anti-fur demonstrations in front of Neiman Marcus. And windows were broken at Neiman Marcus in the middle of the night. I did not know anything about it, and I showed up to the regular weekly protest the next day, which happens every single Sunday from 2 to 4, rain or shine, no matter what. And at the end of the demonstration, cops just swarmed at us and grabbed Josh and I and threw us in a van without telling us why we were being detained or anything about it. And it was really a horrifying experience because I felt like I was going to be accused of this. I had nothing to do with it. I knew nothing about it. And I was very, very frightened. And we went through each individually ruthless interrogations, constant news coverage saying that they had caught the ALF and we are the ALF. It was just really a horrible experience. I went on a hunger strike while I was in jail and was offered vegan food. Josh asked for vegan food and was told they don't have a vegan food policy. So it was ironic how even within the jail, they didn't really want to help us at all. They were only worried about my medical condition and so offered me vegan food. But had I just asked for it outright, I would have been told that I couldn't have it, most likely. Anyway, we each spent a week in jail on a ridiculous bail. I think it was $70,000. We were called terrorists, and really what I found just incredible about the whole thing was that the way that they managed to throw us in jail was they grabbed a heroin addict homeless person off the street and had him pick out two people from the fur demo. They actually brought him to the demo after he failed to pick any people out of photo lineups that they showed him of known protesters. When he couldn't identify anyone from the pictures, he passed over Josh's picture entirely. My photo wasn't even in the composites, and he picked a random woman who wasn't even an activist. In his testimony given before we were ever arrested, he said the woman he saw was medium height, medium build. I'm 6 feet tall. There's no way that his description, even in his previous interview, would have described me. But yet, when they bring him to the street corner, way across the street, and have him pick out two people, he just picks the two tallest people and says, oh, that's them. So we spent a week in jail on it. It took four, and as Josh had said, they were really, really grainy stills. We were slandered all over the media. We got ATF, CIA, and FBI files from this. We were called terrorists. Lieutenant Henry Hunter of the SFPD said, we have a very credible witness, and we have video of these terrorists. And the grainy stills that were produced turned out that you could barely even, the surveillance cameras were worse than the worst 7-Eleven video camera. For Neiman Marcus, that was pretty remarkable. They were the grainiest stills. You could barely recognize that there was a person outside the windows or that windows were being smashed. And the very credible witness turned out to have done heroin on the night in question and drank beer. And he had also killed someone and had his charges brought down to voluntary manslaughter. So this was far from any sort of credible witness. Anyway, we had to go through, like Josh said, the lie detector test, 4 months or so of supervised OR program. And We also had, in effect, a stay away from the store. So while I normally did weekly anti-fur demonstrations during this entire time, I was not able to go for 4 months. So finally, our charges are dropped from complete lack of evidence. Our clothes were never returned. And so within a month of my stay away from Neiman Marcus being lifted, and within a few weeks of me returning in front of Neiman Marcus, I'm handed a grand jury subpoena, which is yet another form of coercement to keep activists from going where they normally go. And when I was handed this, it was shocking because there was so little notice. It was like I was already going to be called to testify within 2 weeks. I was incredibly lucky because a legal team immediately just came and met me at In Defense of Animals, where I worked and still work, and gave me advice and said, this is, you know, we'll support you. Don't worry about it. You just need to figure out what you want to do. Here are your options. You can refuse to cooperate whatsoever, and or you can go in and try to just do the thing where you give your name, or, you know, very, very limited answers where you go in between and speak to your attorney in each instance. And I really wanted an extension, but I was really mortified that somehow by calling and speaking to the prosecutor, I would be, you really don't want to lie. You almost don't want to communicate whatsoever. It's once you start talking to the FBI, even in terms of making an appointment, you're already talking to them. And so I was working with an experienced civil rights attorney, Larry Weiss, who many of you know. He's been a Sonoma County attorney for a long time and helped out many, many, many of us animal rights activists over the years. And Derek St. Pierre, who also some of you may know, he helped out with that portion of the case. And I want to at this point also say Mark Ramon was amazing because he was Josh's attorney throughout this and really led our defense for the Neiman Marcus case, where we were not involved in it and yet had to each spend a week in jail and go through all that. And so we had I now had the grand jury subpoena, and as you can imagine, that deterred other people from really wanting to attend the protests, because, you know, if you can't be made to stay away from a stay away order and you come back after that and then you're handed grand jury subpoenas, it really seems like you're being very discouraged from holding regular weekly protests. And so what we ended up doing was my attorney said, well, you know, maybe you want to contact them and just ask for the extension. So I actually did it by fax and certified mail because I didn't want to actually communicate with them. Larry Weiss also recommended, and this turned out to be really beneficial, that I go more on the offensive. And so what I did was I asked for a list of wiretaps going on at every single known activist that I knew that I'd made phone calls from. And that helped too, because there are some limited rights you have to ask for the prosecution. And when I asked for the extension, I actually never got a response, which ended up being a good thing because it will make the prosecutor look irresponsible. If you're in front of this very, very large oppressive government investigation and the one little thing you ask for, an extension, is completely ignored. And so under some confidence that my request had been ignored, I felt even better about the fact that I was going to refuse to testify. And I was infinitely lucky that I had so many great coworkers and so many great activists in the Bay Area to help me, because we had a workshop similar to this set up within about a week of my grand jury subpoena, and we had a demonstration set up for the morning I was to go in and testify. And so instead of going up and testifying, we held a press conference in front of the federal courthouse. And it was like the best thing I've ever seen in my life, to see about 50 people at 8 a.m. with anti-FBI signs in front of the federal courthouse. There were people all up on the roof filming us from every law enforcement agency imaginable. And it was just so impressive to be able to just give a statement over a megaphone that I wasn't going to cooperate and come get me if you want and then just go home. And and then we sent out press releases the next weekend for the fur demo, because I was fairly certain I would be picked up then. And then I really spent the next year or so looking over my shoulder, waiting to be grabbed, and nothing ever happened. So I got, you know, my method worked for me, and I know there's a lot of different things people have to consider about which method will work best for them, whether they want to flat out refuse or whether they want to go in the room and answer certain questions. And I was very fortunate because my boss, Dr. Katz, volunteered to pay my rent as an IDA employee if I did end up going into jail. So my cats and animals were taken care of, and so I felt, well, at the very least, I'll just end up in jail, but my animals will be okay, and I've got a great support team, so I can do this. And so it's that you have a really good network of friends who aren't necessarily activists, but people who will take care of your animals if you go into jail, people who will find you a roommate if you need to, so that in the case that it's not just the movement. So I really think that's important, to foster a network of people and not write them off because they won't necessarily do everything that you would do and demonstrate on behalf of animals, but that really admire and respect what you're doing and want to help you if you get in a situation where you're really facing a lot of government oppression. And so I think that's it, but I also really want to thank Mark Bavlon again and Josh for being a wonderful co-defendant and just so great for animals. All right, I do want to say one last thing. I have a binder which has all the documents and stuff from our arrest, including the photo lineups of Josh and I where we weren't picked out, the rap sheet of the heroin addict witness, all that sort of stuff, my grand jury subpoena. So anyone who wants to look at it can come here after the presentation.
Okay, and we have one more speaker tonight. And follow up after he's finished, we'll open up to some questions and answers. And that's Claude Marks. Claude Marks is the project director of the Freedom Archives, the Political, Cultural, Oral History Project in San Francisco. He's a former political prisoner who served time for security of ranked 2 Puerto Rican and Black political prisoners out of Leavenworth. Claude taught ESL literacy, writing, and history inside. Claude remains a prison activist and uses media to educate and advocate for prison abolition and the freedom of all political prisoners.
Thank you for inviting me. I wanted to broaden the discussion a little bit. Not that I don't support the work of everyone here. I think the way to start is that the levels of resistance to this government and what it stands for are very long-standing. And the grand jury is one method of coercion that, you know, have been very well spoken to by people so far. But I want to recognize also the fact that people's commitment to really transform and fight for a different set of values and a different vision of what the world can be like leads to tremendous consequences. That's a very heavy decision that weighs on people, and once it's made, it's not just an issue of coercion that tries to dissuade us. So we have a lot of challenges before us. And I've been doing work around political prisoners for over 30 years, apart from the fact that I served time myself. If you don't realize it, there are political prisoners that are in their 30th and 40th years in this country for doing precisely what I described, is fighting for a different vision of what is possible. The vast majority of them come out of the Black Liberation Movement, out of the Native American struggle, out of, you know, the Chicano-Mexicano movement, out of the Puerto Rican movement. There are also white anti-imperialists who continue to serve. There's a lot of people who didn't survive their commitment. People who were, in fact, targeted by this government, killed in the course of their participation in these various movements. So that by the early 70s, there were over 40 Black Panthers that were killed in the course of being targeted because of what they were trying to construct within their struggle. Those that survived may yet be inside. I know them personally, some of them, and you know, I visit somebody fairly regularly who was busted at the age of 19, and he and I celebrated his 32nd year in prison a year and a half ago. And so I've known this human being more than half of my life, and he's still struggling for his freedom. So the consequences are substantial, and the grand jury is one element of trying to dissuade us from standing in the way of what they're trying to accomplish, whether it's about eco struggles or animal rights or liberation of one's community and one's people. These are all part of a fabric of resistance. So in a way, I would like to challenge you to take it on in a very serious way. If you're making a commitment to struggle, it means that you, if you're willing to go up against the U.S. state and the government of this country, you've got to be willing to follow through, or we can't build a movement that's going to succeed in the long run. And so there's a selflessness that you have to be willing to undergo, a transformation, and that so the commitment has grave consequences and is long term. For me, you know, I'm happy to say that I was a political prisoner because I feel quite satisfied that my commitment led me to that experience. I learned from it. I grew from it. I've come out. I continue to do dedicated work, and that's part of what the scheme is, if that's what your life commitment is. And so I want to give some concrete examples of some other forms of repression. I've mentioned the political prisoners. There is currently a grand jury in San Francisco that within the last days has subpoenaed five people who are former members of the Black Panther Party or the Black Liberation Army or their supporters, around 30-plus-year-old cases around activities that happened in response to the murder of George Jackson in 1971 and things of that nature that resulted in some cops being killed. In the mid-70s, people were arrested in New Orleans, and they were tortured. And as a result of that, this investigation opened up. But because in that particular period historically, because of coercive testimony under torture, the U.S. government had to essentially fold up its case. In this political climate, that same case and the same people are being targeted. It includes some of the people who are still locked up to this day in terms of who's being targeted around these investigations. But because they feel that in this climate they have a level of impunity, they have a level of impunity to conduct torture, that's very clear, whether it's Abu Ghraib or the Attica Rebellion, which, if you don't know about it, there was a tremendous amount of torture after this rebellion to take over the Attica prison in New York. That impunity is expensive. And so despite having dropped this case in the mid-70s, they're now re-raising it. And they're subpoenaing the same people that they tortured. And it's not just a coincidence that the two cops from San Francisco who were present during the tortures in New Orleans in the mid-70s have been made the lead federal investigators around this particular grand jury. So these torturers are now the lead investigators to reopen the case. That's the kind of stuff that we also have to address. I don't want to diminish the need to support the people that are subpoenaed in this room, but I think the larger picture is part of what we need to talk about. And it's the subpoenas that we're talking about here, an element of it, the same kind of stuff is happening. So our movement has to be much more inclusive and much broader and see the conflict on a larger scale. I want to mention one other person that falls into this attack against the Black movement. Kamal Siddiqui, who was arrested in November of 2003, was a former Panther, actually did time in the 70s around a bank robbery, happens to be the father of Assata Shakur's child, was arrested after living publicly, working the same job for 20 years in New York, hauled down to Atlanta, and charged with a cop killing. Flimsy evidence, the political climate being what it is, was convicted. Basically, he was offered the following deal: help us get Assata Shakur, who is in exile in Cuba, the former Panther, former member of the Black Liberation Army, help us get her and we'll cut you loose. Here he is, a sick, positive, in poor health, living with his family in New York.